9 years to go.
Ali. She walks and hides. Hides and walks for 82 days. Takes rides where she can, but mostly walks. To start with, there's not much trouble finding someone willing to give a 16-year-old girl a ride, crisscrossing the state, covering her tracks. But as she travels north, and as the summer turns to autumn, fewer drivers answer her stuck-out hitching thumb. More of them swerve, panicked away from her, even though she's not in the highway. One woman makes the sign of the cross as her husband drives on. Ali bought a sleeping bag early on from Goodwill. It smells, but she airs it out every morning and it hasn't rained hard yet. She's been enjoying the journey, though her belly is empty most of the time and her feet are sore. There have been mornings she's woken just past dawn and seen the hard, bright edges of the trees and path drawn fresh by the morning sun and felt the light glittering in her lungs, and she's been glad to be there. Once, there was a grey fox that kept pace with her for 3 days, walking a few arms' lengths away, never coming close enough to touch, but never drifting too far away either, except to take a rat once, returning with the body soft in her mouth and the blood on her muzzle. Ali said to the voice, "Is she a sign?" And the voice said, "Oh yes, keep on truckin', girl." Ali hasn't been reading the newspapers, and she hasn't been listening to her little radio. She doesn't know it, but she's missed the day of the girls completely. She doesn't know that that's what saved her life. Back in Jacksonville, Mrs. Montgomery Taylor walked upstairs at bedtime, expecting to find her husband in his study reading the paper, and the girl suitably chastened on the subject of her misdeeds. In the girl's bedroom, she saw what was to be seen. Ali had left Mr. Montgomery Taylor with his pants around his ankles, his member still partially tumescent, a blood of foam staining the cream rug. Mrs. Montgomery Taylor sat on the rumpled bed for a full half hour, just looking at Clyde Montgomery Taylor. She breathed, after a first quick gasp, slowly and evenly. "The Lord giveth," she said to the empty room at last, "and the Lord taketh away." She pulled Clyde's pants up and remade the bed with fresh linens, being careful to step around him. She thought of propping him up in a chair at his desk and laundering the rug, but although she grieved for the indignity of him there, tongue in the floor, she doubted she had the strength for it. Besides, the story told itself better if he'd been in the girl's room, delivering the catechism. She summoned the police, and when the men came sympathetic at midnight, she gave testimony. To have given a home to the wolf and succor to the rabid dog. She had photographs of Ali. That would have been plenty enough to find her in a few days if, that very night, the calls had not started to this police station and the one in Albany and Statesboro, and on through the country spreading out, branching and rebranching. The calls lighten up the police stations like a vast and spreading web. In a town on the coast, whose name she never knows, Ali finds a good sleeping place in the scrubby wood that skims the houses. A sheltered bank with a warm, dry place to curl up, where the rock is curved under into a lip. She stays there for 3 days, because the voice says, "There's something here for you, my girl. Seek and go fetch." She's tired and hungry all of the time, so that a light-headed feeling has become part of her, pleasant in its way. She can hear the voice more clearly when her muscles are buzzing like this, and it's been a while since her last meal. It's tempted her to stop eating in the past, particularly because she's sure the tones of the voice, its low, amused rumble, are the notes of her own mother speaking. Ali doesn't really remember her mother, although she knows she had one, of course. The world began for her in a bright flash when she was somewhere between 3 or 4. She had been at the mall with someone, because she had a balloon in one hand and a snow cone in the other, and the someone, not her mother, she's sure of that, she'd know that, was saying, "Now, you must call this lady Aunt Rose, and she will be kind to you." It was in that moment that she first heard the voice. When she looked up into Aunt Rose's face, and the voice said, "Kind? Sure. Uh-huh. I don't think so." The voice has never steered her wrong since then. Aunt Rose turned out to be a mean old lady who'd call Allie bad names when she had a little to drink, and she liked to drink most every day. The voice told Allie what to do, how to pick the right teacher at school, and tell the story in such a way that she didn't seem to be saying it artfully at all. But the lady after Aunt Rose was even worse, and Mrs. Montgomery Taylor was worse than that. Still, the voice has kept her safe from the worst harm all these years. She still has all her fingers and toes, though that's been a near-run thing. And now it's telling her, "Stay here. Wait for it." She walks into town every day and explores every place that's warm and dry and where they don't throw her out. The library, the church, the little overheated museum of the Revolutionary War. And on the third day, she manages to sneak into the aquarium. It's off-season. No one's minding the door so hard, and it's only a small place anyway. 5 rooms strung together at the end of a line of stores. "Wonders of the deep," says the sign outside. Allie waits until the guy on the door has wandered off to get a soda, leaving a "back in 20 minutes" sign, and she flips open the little wooden door and walks straight in. Because it's warm, really. And because the voice told her to look everywhere. No stone unturned. She can feel there's something here for her as soon as she walks into the room full of brightly lit tanks with fish of 100 coloured kinds patrolling the water back and forth. She feels it across her chest, in her collarbone, down to her fingers. There's something here. Another girl who can do the thing she can do. No, not a girl. Allie feels out again with that other sense, the one that tingles. She's seen a little bit about it online. Other girls saying they can sense if another woman in the room is about to discharge her power. But no one has it like Allie has it. Since she first got her power, she's been able to tell at once if anyone around her had any at all. And there's something here. She finds it in the last tank but one, a darker tank than the rest, without the coloured, garlanded and fronded fish. It contains long, dark and sinuous creatures waiting at the bottom of the tank, stirring slowly. There's a meter box to one side of the tank with its needle at zero. Allie has never seen them before, nor does she know their name. She puts her hand to the glass. One of the eels shifts, turns and does something. She can hear it, a fizzing, cracking sound. The needle on the meter jumps. But Allie doesn't need to know what the box is, to know what just happened. This fish made a jolt. There's a board up on the wall next to the tank. It's so exciting that she has to read it 3 times and keep herself under control or her breathing goes fast. "These are electric eels. They can do crazy things. They give shocks to their prey underwater. Yeah, that's right." Allie makes a little arc between her finger and thumb under the table. The eels stir in the tank. That's not all electric eels can do. They can remote control the muscles in their prey by interfering with the electric signals in the brain. They can make those fish swim straight into their mouths if they want to. Allie stands for a long time with that. She puts her hand back on the glass. She looks at the animals. "That is a mighty power indeed. You would have to have control. Why? But you've always had control, daughter." And you'd have to be skillful. Why? But you can learn those skills. Allie says in her heart, Mother, where shall I go? And the voice says, Leave this place and go from here to the place that I shall show you. The voice always did have a biblical way with it, just like that. That night, Allie wants to settle to sleeping, but the voice says, No, go on walking. Keep on. Her stomach is so empty, and she feels peculiar, lightheaded, troubled in her mind with thoughts of Mr. Montgomery Taylor, as if his lolling tongue were still licking at her ear. She wishes she had a dog. The voice says, Nearly there, my girl. Don't you worry. And out of the darkness, Allie sees a light, illuminating a sign. It says, Sisters of Mercy Convent, soup for the homeless and beds for those in need. The voice says, See, I told you. And all Allie knows after she crosses the threshold is that three women take her up bodily, calling her child and sweet, and exclaiming when they find the crucifix in her bag, because this is the proof of what they'd hoped to find in her face. They bring the food to her while she sits up, barely conscious, in a soft, warm bed. And that night, not a one of them asked who she was and where she'd come from. There is very little attention paid to a mixed-race child, with no home and no family, washed up at a convent on the eastern seaboard in those months. She is not the only girl who beaches on this shore. Nor is she the one most in need of counsel. The sisters are glad to find a use for the empty bedrooms. They are living in a building too large for them, built almost 100 years ago, when the Lord was still calling women by the fistful to his eternal marriage. By the time 3 months have passed, they have put in bunk beds and tacked up a schedule of classes and Sunday school and given out chores in exchange for meals and comforters and a roof over the head. There has been a great tide in the movement of people, and those old ways have taken precedence again. Girls thrown out onto the street, the nuns will take them in. Allie likes to get the stories out of the other girls. She becomes a confidant, a pal, to several of them, so she can match her tale up to theirs. There's Savannah, who struck her stepbrother across the face so hard, she says, Spider's webs grew on him. They grew right over his mouth and his nose and even his eyes. Savannah tells this story wide-eyed, chewing her gum enthusiastically. Allie digs her fork into the tough old stewing meat the nuns serve for dinner thrice weekly. She says, What are you gonna do now? And Savannah says, I'm gonna find a doctor who'll take it out of me. Cut that thing right out. A clue. There are others. Some of the girls were prayed over by parents who thought a demon had possessed them. Some fought with other girls. Some are still fighting here. One had done the thing to a boy because he asked her to. This story holds much interest for the girls. Could it be that boys like it? Is it possible they want it? Some of them have found internet forums that suggest that this is the case. There's one girl, Victoria, who showed her mother how to do the thing. Her mother, who Victoria says as simply as if she were talking about the weather, had been beaten so hard and so often by Victoria's stepdad that she hasn't a tooth left in her head. Victoria woke the power up in her with a touch of her hand and showed her how to use it. And her mother threw her out into the street, calling her a witch. None of them needs an internet forum to understand that. They all nod, and someone passes Victoria the jug of gravy. In a less chaotic time, there might have been police or social services or earnest folk from the school board asking what was going on with these girls. But the authorities are simply grateful that someone is helping them out. Someone asks Allie what happened to her, and she knows she can't give her real name. She calls herself Eve, and the voice says, "Good choice. The first of women. Excellent choice." Eve's story is simple. Not interesting enough to be remembered. Eve's from Augusta, and her parents sent her to relatives for 2 weeks. And when she came back, they'd moved away. She doesn't know where. She had 2 younger brothers. Her parents were scared for them, she thinks, although she'd never hurt no one. The other girls nod and move on to someone else. "It's not what I've done," Ally thinks to herself. "It's what I'm going to do." And the voice says, "It's what Eve's going to do." And Ally says, "Yes." She likes it in the convent. The nuns, for the most part, are kind, and the company of women is pleasing to Ally. She's not found the company of men has had much to recommend it. The girls have chores to complete, but when they're done, there's the ocean for swimming and the beach for walking. There are swings out back, and the singing in chapel is peaceful and quiets all the voices in Ally's head. She finds herself thinking in those quiet times, "Maybe I could stay here forever. To dwell in the house of God all the days of my life is my one request." There is one nun, Sister Maria Ignatia, who particularly draws Ally's attention. She has dark skin like Ally herself, and soft brown eyes. Sister Maria Ignatia likes to tell stories of the childhood of Jesus, and of how his mother, Mary, was always kind to him and taught him to love all living things. "See," Sister Maria Ignatia says to the girls who gather to listen to her before evensong, "our Lord learned from a woman how to love, and Mary is close to all children. She is close to you now and has brought you to our door." One evening, after the others have gone, Ally leans her head against Sister Maria Ignatia's knee and says, "Can I live here all my life?" Sister Maria Ignatia strokes her hair and says, "Oh, you would have to become a nun to stay here. And you might decide you want other things from your life. A husband and children? A job?" Ally thinks, this is always the answer. They never want you to stay forever. They always say they love you, but they never want you to stay. And the voice says, very quietly, "Daughter, if you want to stay, I can fix that for you." Ally says to the voice, "Are you Mary, the mother?" And the voice says, "If you like, my dear, if that's what floats your boat." Ally says, "They never want to keep me, though, do they? I never get to stay." And the voice says, "If you want to stay, you'll have to make this place your own. Think about how to do that. Don't worry. You'll figure it out." The girls play at fighting, trying out their skills on each other. In the water, on the land, giving each other little jolts and thrills. Ally uses that time to practice too, although she's more subtle about it. She doesn't want them to know what she's doing, remembering the thing she read about the electric eels. She manages, after a long time, to send out a tiny jolt that will make one of the other girl's arm or leg jump. "Ow!" says Savannah, as her shoulder flies upwards. "Someone walk over my grave." "Ha!" says Victoria, as Ally jangles her brain a little. "I have a headache. I can't think straight." "Fuck!" shouts Abigail as her knees buckle. "Got a fucking cramp from the water." It doesn't take much power to do it. And it doesn't hurt them. They never know it was Ally. Like the eels in the tank. Her head just above the waterline. Her eyes wide and steady. After a few months, some of the other girls start to talk about moving on from the convent. It's occurred to Ally, or Eve as she's trying to think of herself, even in private, that some of the others might have secrets too. Might also be hiding here until the heat dies down. One of the girls, they call her Gordy because her surname's Gordon, asks Allie to come with her. "We're going to Baltimore," she says. "My mom's family has people there. They'll help us get set up." She shifts her shoulders. "I'd like your company along the way." Eve has made friends, in a way Allie has always found difficult. Eve is kind and quiet and watchful, where Allie was spiky and complicated. She cannot go back to where she came from. And what indeed would there be to return for? But there will be no great hunt for her. She looks different now, anyway. Her face longer and leaner, her frame taller. It is that time in life when children start to wear their adult faces. She could walk north to Baltimore, or move on to some other nowhere town and take a job as a waitress. In 3 years' time, no one back in Jacksonville would know her for certain. Or she could stay here. When Gordy says,
"Come away,"
Allie knows she wants to stay. She is happier here than she has ever been. She listens at doors and around corners. She has always had this habit. A child in danger must learn to pay more attention to the adults than a child loved and cherished. That is how she hears the nuns arguing between themselves, and how she learns she might not have the chance to stay at all. It is Sister Veronica, her face like granite, whose voice Allie hears through the door of their small sitting room.
"Have you seen it?"
she is saying.
"Have you seen it working?"
"We have all seen it," rumbles the abbess.
"Then how can you doubt what it is?"
"Fairy stories," says Sister Maria Ignatia. "Children's games." Sister Veronica's voice is so loud it makes the door tremble a little, and Allie takes a pace back.
"Are the Gospels themselves fairy tales? Was our Lord a liar? Do you tell me that there has never been a demon, that when he cast out devils from men, he was playing a game?"
"No one is saying that, Veronica. No one is doubting the Gospels."
"Have you seen it on the news reports? Have you seen what they do? They have powers that men are not meant to know. From where does this power come? We all know the answer. The Lord told us where these powers come from. We all know."
There is a silence in the room. Sister Maria Ignatia speaks softly.
"I have heard that it is caused by pollution. There was an interesting piece in the newspaper. Pollution in the atmosphere, causing certain mutations in the..."
"It is the devil! The devil walks abroad and tests the innocent and the guilty, giving powers to the damned as he has always done."
"Oh, no," says Sister Maria Ignatia. "I have seen the good in their faces. They are children. We have a duty to care for them."
"You would see good in the face of Satan himself if he arrived at your door with a pitiful story and a hungry belly."
"And would I be so wrong to do so if Satan needed feeding?"
Sister Veronica gives a laugh like a dog's bark.
Good intentions pave the road to hell."
The abbess speaks over them all.
"We have already asked for guidance to the diocesan council. They are praying on it. In the meantime, the Lord told us to suffer the little children. Younger girls awaken it in older women. This is the devil working in the world, passing from hand to hand as Eve passed the apple to Adam."
"We cannot simply throw children out onto the street."
"The devil will gather them to his bosom."
"Or they will starve," says Sister Maria Ignatia.
Allie thinks it over for a long time. She could move on. But she likes it here. The voice says,
"You heard what she said. Eve passed the apple to Adam."
Allie thinks, maybe she was right to do it. Maybe that's what the world needed. A bit of shaking up. Something new. The voice says,
"That's my girl."
Allie thinks,
Are you God?
The voice says, Who do you say that I am?
Allie thinks, I know that you speak to me in my hour of need. I know that you have guided me on the true path. Tell me what to do now. Tell me.
The voice says,
If the world didn't need shaken up, why would this power have come alive now?
Allie thinks, God is telling the world that there is to be a new order, that the old way is overturned, the old centuries are done. Just as Jesus told the people of Israel that God's desires had changed, the time of the Gospels is over, and there must be a new doctrine.
The voice says,
There is a need for a prophet in the land.
Allie thinks, But who?
The voice says,
Just try it on for size, honey. Remember, if you're going to stay here, you're going to need to own the place so they can't take it from you. The only way you're safe, honey bun, is if you own it.